Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Hanford Nuclear Reservation, along the Columbia River, 200 miles upstream from Portland, is one of the most contaminated places on the planet, housing a nasty concentration of radioactive and toxic chemical waste that was supposed to be cleaned up years ago. But last month, the Trump administration once again proposed to cut a massive amount from the Hanford cleanup budget. Today, we talk with Tom Carpenter, executive director of Hanford Challenge in Seattle, about why these cuts would be so devastating to the cleanup effort, especially in light of the urgency to stabilize Hanford's crumbling infrastructure, which could imminently collapse, unleashing even more contamination. Tom, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start by just giving people who might not remember a kind of a refresher course on what Hanford is, why it's there, and why it's so dangerous.
Oh, sure. Well, Hanford is a plutonium factory, and it was started in World War II to make plutonium to make the first nuclear bombs. And after World War II, it made the plutonium for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, Hanford really ramped up, and it went from having one reactor to nine reactors just to make plutonium and just really expanded its production so that Hanford produced a huge amount of plutonium for the Cold War and for most of our nuclear weapons. And so that mission ended in the late 1980s. However, plutonium production was very dirty. It contaminated huge areas of the Hanford site. And so the leftover issue is still plaguing us, and the Hanford site is, as you said, considered the most contaminated facility in the Western Hemisphere, and we spent as taxpayers tens of billions of dollars on the cleanup so far with not much result, especially when it comes to containing or cleaning up the high-level waste. And the cleanup is supposed to last for many more decades and cost up to $660 billion, according to figures released by the Department of Energy last year. However, that's all in doubt now because of cuts being proposed by the Trump administration and others. So that's kind of the refresher course. It's an amazingly dirty, complex facility that's really old. A lot of old infrastructure out there. So there's a lot at stake in making sure this place gets cleaned up.
Well, the first time I was out there, which was in 1982, they were still producing plutonium at that point, and they wanted to. I think they were trying to develop the fast flux breeder reactor, and they still had the N reactor going, which was this weird hybrid power reactor and plutonium producing reactor. They were talking about cleanup back then, and I was there the next year, and they were still talking about cleanup. And then I was there about 10 years later, and at that point, they had changed their mission from being producing plutonium to cleaning up, and they were promoting themselves as being a wildlife refuge at that point. But they were still, it seemed like they hadn't come very far in the cleanup, and this is, we're talking now about a span of 20 years. And then I was there again last spring for the Hanford Journey that the Columbia River Keeper and the Yakima Nation sponsored, and I saw that there was some improvement. So before we talk about all the horrors that still have not been met, let's talk about some of the things that have changed between 1982 and the present.
Well, sure. Well, the biggest change is they did quit making plutonium. They quit running reactors, and they stopped the reprocessing of spent nuclear fuel. And that is a huge improvement over what was happening. Probably it's one of the dirtiest industrial processes to reprocess nuclear fuel, which is to take nuclear fuel from a reactor that's been reacted and dissolve that in acid and separate out the plutonium or highly enriched uranium that might be in the fuel still, and there's a leftover product. So that in and of itself was great news. And that happened in about 1987, that mission ended. And since then, in 1989, the state of Washington and the EPA and the Department of Energy, which is a federal agency, entered into a cleanup agreement with milestones and deadlines. And that agreement is still in place, and obviously it's about 31 years old at this point. And unfortunately, they've missed a lot of the deadlines. I think there's been about 800 deadlines that had to be reset. There have been several court actions to force the federal government to live up to the deadlines. But on the good news side of things, all the reactors have been cocooned or mothballed.
Which means what?
All of the facilities around the reactor, all except the reactor core, have been taken down, except for the B reactor. And that's a historic site as what the first reactor out there, and it only operated for a couple of years.
It's a museum now, right?
It is. It's a museum. You can go visit it. And
is the core still there, though? Or I mean, is it?
No. the radioactive core is, but all the nuclear fuel is long gone. And so it's the big core. I mean, the whole idea about cocooning or mothballing these reactors is to let the radiation die down for about 100 years before taking them apart and burying them somewhere. Because they are quite radioactive at this point, but the radioactivity is contained within the reactor cores. All the fuel's been removed. A lot of cleanup has happened along the river corridor, and that's good news. They recently completed removing radioactive sludge and materials from what's called the K basins, which is like a parking lot swimming pool for spent nuclear fuel that never got processed. And that was a very difficult and expensive proposition to finally empty that pool of all that radioactive materials, but it was a huge safety threat, and that safety threat has now been remediated. There's been some success in groundwater remediation, what they call pump and treat, and that's where they pump water out of the ground that's contaminated, and they run it through a series of filters to remove various contaminants. And, there's been billions of gallons of water treated this way, which sounds like a lot, but there's an estimated 440 billion gallons of contaminated water below the Hanford site. They've got quite a long ways to go to get to it all, but at least, you know, they are making a dent in that process. A lot of buildings have been remediated just last month. The plutonium finishing plant was finally taken down all the way, but not without a big cost, both in terms of money and in worker health and safety. About 42 workers were found to have inhaled plutonium specks and particles into their lungs because of, frankly, the carelessness of the contractor and not protecting the workers sufficiently. There's a lot of bumps in the road, but slowly progress is being made. Unfortunately, you know, the crux of this cleanup is the high-level nuclear waste in these giant underground nuclear waste tanks. And there's about 177 of these tanks, and a third of them have leaked and failed, and about 1 million gallons or more is in the soil below the tanks because of holes in the tanks. They all will fail. And the race is on to remove waste from these ancient, creaking, nasty old tanks and treat that waste and dispose of it properly before more tanks leak. We've spent, as taxpayers, according to the GAO, from a report that's now 2 years old, $19 billion on dispositioning this tank waste, that is trying to clean up the tank waste, and yet very little of it, if any, has actually been treated or taken care of. So now it kind of brings us up to the present. In the last year and a half, the Trump administration is proposing to not treat that tank waste after all, that a good deal of it will remain in the tanks. In order to accomplish that, by law, high-level waste has to be removed, treated, and disposed of in a deep geological repository. And this goes all the way back to 1957, when the National Research Council said that this waste is dangerous in such tiny, tiny quantities for such a long time, millions of years, that the waste has to be disposed of so that it does not come into contact with any living thing. So putting it deep underground has been the goal.
But where?
Have heard of.
As you're talking, I keep thinking about all these times that I've been at Hanford talking to these people. I was realizing I've always been there during Republican administration, so I wonder if it's better during the Democratic administrations. It's hard to tell. But these stories that I would hear from scientists back 20, 30 years ago about how we know what we're doing, we're going to do something, and then the next round comes and it's a different contractor because they keep changing contractors, and they don't seem to... Well, one of the things that struck me in the information that you gave me is how much money was spent in the first 20 years and like nothing seemed to be cleaned up. So how does this happen that there can be so much money spent and nothing really seems to change?
Well, it goes to the system that was created to make plutonium. The government had zero interest in making it themselves, and they hired contractors to come in and do it for them. And so they simply set schedules for plutonium production and said, give us this much plutonium this month. And they little regard was given for the environment or protecting worker health and safety. That's well established. There have been numerous congressional hearings and media exposés and whistleblowers to come out and testify about that. And unfortunately, Congress did not change that system of the government hiring contractors to come in and just do it. And so they put these contractors on, these projects that are incentivized by deadlines. And so to meet the deadlines, there's very little penalty for violating environmental law or putting worker health and safety at risk. So they just go at breakneck speeds and take shortcuts. Plus, the system is rife with opportunities for fraud. And in fact, there's been a lot of fraud. There's been prosecutions for fraud. Contractors, CH2M Hill, back a few years back, was fined $18 million for criminal fraud. They pled guilty to numerous felonies, and several workers were also prosecuted, and managers. Another set of whistleblowers brought fraud claims against Bechtel and another company called AECOM. This was related to the waste treatment plant. That fraud case was settled with the government because the government intervened in that case for $125 million paid out by Bechtel and AECOM. They did not admit fault or plead guilty to anything. And they still work out there. CH2, AECOM still has contracts out there. So it doesn't seem to matter if you commit fraud or crimes at the Hanford site if you're a contractor. So a lot of money just kind of disappears because nobody's looking. And it's up to whistleblowers to point it out. Then they get fired and sometimes prosecuted for doing that. So there's not a whole lot of incentive to change the system. Sometimes I refer to Hanford as the ATM in the desert for contractors because there's so little oversight. And periodically, the Government Accountability Office, GAO, comes in, does investigations for Congress, and puts out another report saying, man, things are messed up here, and, you've got a lot of fraud opportunities, and you haven't fixed it yet. And there's So there's no oversight is really what it comes down to. And there is a part of that issue is a revolving door between the Department of Energy, who owns the site and is a federal agency, and the people who work there. Oftentimes, the senior managers there will just cycle to become consultants or actually officers for these same contractors that they were just overseeing. And their salary goes up by fourfold or tenfold. You know, so this is kind of a retirement plan. And if you're not seen as being reasonable with the contractor, then, you know, there's no nice man with a paycheck waiting for you when you retire, right? You're done. And but if you've been reasonable and were soft on the contractors and didn't demand a lot of oversight, you know, then you would get these fat consulting jobs. And there's many, many, many former Department of Energy site managers and scientists and regulators that have, and ecology too, by the way, is, you know, for the state, that have ended up working for these very same contractors that they used to regulate. So that also contributes to essentially an atmosphere that is, you know, rife with opportunities for fraud. It's a system to make money, and unfortunately, it's not just economic crime. This has, you know, dire impacts on the actual cleanup that is supposed to be happening to protect this region's health and safety.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And we'd like to welcome Coast Radio, Coast Community Radio as well. They starting to broadcast Locus Focus this week, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Tom Carpenter, who's executive director of Hanford Challenge in Seattle. We're talking about the increasing challenges of cleaning up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Well, you mentioned there's two DOEs here. There's the Department of Energy, that's the federal agency, and then there's the Washington Department of Ecology. And I remember back in the 80s, activists who were trying to clean up, well, first shut down and then clean up Hanford, were very concerned that the Department of Ecology was not being very firm in their negotiations with Hanford. You sent me a copy of a letter that somebody from DOE sent to the other DOE, basically threatening them with lawsuits if they don't meet their obligations. So have things changed with the Washington State Department of Ecology, and are they starting to stand up to Hanford?
Yeah, the Washington State Department of Ecology has really taken an aggressive posture. They've run out of patience. They've appointed people who have actual environmental oversight experience with a background, for instance, in the toxic and hazardous waste facilities as lawyers. You know, one of them is Alex Smith, and she is the head of the nuclear waste program for the Department of Ecology at the Hanford site. And, you know, they do have to walk a tightrope in terms of, you know, they have a Hanford community there that, you know, wants to keep Hanford happy. They've got groups like ours and Heart of America and Columbia River Keeper, the tribes, et cetera, pushing them pretty hard to stick to a cleanup schedule. But there have been enough lawsuits and enough broken promises and lies, basically, by the Department of Energy that they've kind of reached the end of their rope. They also have, you know, deep concerns about whether or not the federal government will actually conduct this cleanup. And that's kind of what's driving everyone right now is if the Department of Energy succeeds in relabeling high-level waste in these tanks and call it low-level waste, then they won't remove the waste and treat it and put it into a deep geological repository. They will leave that waste in these tanks, you know, or remove it and leave it a shallow land burial, one or the other, but it will stay on site and not get disposed of properly. So that's our great concern right now. The Department of Energy has made these proposals. They're going through the public comment process right now on that. There's, you know, litigation that will likely occur. And, you know, we are very interested in making sure, as is the state of Washington, that this waste is actually removed from these tanks or dug up from the soil that's contaminated with this high-level waste and putting it into a deep geological repository as is required by law. Instead, there's a lot of plans out there to simply pump this waste full of concrete, so put concrete in the tanks and walk away. That is not an acceptable solution. The concrete won't hold for very long, and it will simply leak into our groundwater eventually and contaminate the Columbia River. And, you know, it's just not, it's a kick the can down the road approach that is scary to everybody. It'll be hard to recover from that as well. These are massive tanks. Each tank holds up to 1 million gallons, the size of a four-story apartment building covering the whole block. So you can imagine if that was a concrete hulk, you know, the difficulties you would have later on in trying to dig that out of the ground. But if eventually that's probably what would happen. So, you know, we are fighting to make sure this does not happen, that the tri-party agreement, the cleanup agreement, is honored. But we're pretty happy to have the state as a partner with us, you know, on Hanford and oversight. We have, you know, clearly aligned goals, and we're hoping they stay the course and make the federal government do what it's supposed to do.
How much clout do you think the state has?
Well, right now they've got a lot of clout. They can regulate what happens with this waste to an extent. It's a little complicated because the state is not able to regulate radioactive materials. It can only regulate chemicals. And that goes back to the founding of the Atomic Energy Act and the atomic energy agencies back in the 40s and 50s, where Congress says, well, this is national security related and nobody understands it, you know, as well as these agencies, the Atomic Energy Agency, which eventually broke up into the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So those are the two federal agencies that regulate radioactivity, and including disposal. However, most of the waste, if not all of it, at Hanford is actually mixed with chemicals. So that Washington State is able to regulate the chemicals in those wastes, but it's not sufficient to really protect us. Because the radioactive part is really what's long-lived and dangerous in such tiny quantities. But they do have that power, and they can exercise that to an extent. One fix that we would like to see undertaken by Congress is make these radioactive pollutants subject to the environmental laws, stop treating those radioactive materials as privileged pollutants, and assign them standards where you cannot leave that waste buried in the soil, for instance, past a certain quantity, which is what we do for hazardous chemicals. It's like mercury, you know, if you hit a certain level, you can't leave it there. So you have to treat it and dispose of it properly. And right now, unfortunately, the state does not have that power, and we've actually talked with Senator Wyden about this and other members of Congress, and they're getting quite interested in that as a possible fix. But the issue is always what will Congress do if they get tired of spending money on Hanford, apparently uselessly, right? And it's a lot of money. So the Department of Energy is offering Congress a way out of spending all that money and saying, we could just relabel the waste, and we don't have to spend all this money. We'll be the ones here in the Pacific Northwest left with the fallout from that decision, and I mean that literally. So there's another issue to talk about, which is just last month, the GAO issued a report on the fact that that Hanford and the Department of Energy is ignoring and has not done a good job on making sure that old facilities out there and caches of radioactive materials, et cetera, are actually being remediated. They're not inspecting those. And, you know, listeners may remember that there was a tunnel collapse called the Purex Tunnel a few years back. And the Purex Tunnel has a lot of radioactive materials in it. It's an old tunnel that they just kind of used and didn't pay much attention to. And although internal reports said this thing's going to collapse, the Department of Energy was way too slow in dealing with it. And when a collapse did happen in part of the tunnel, they had to quickly pump that tunnel full of concrete simply to stop it from collapsing on itself and, you know, potentially releasing a lot of radioactive materials into the environment. The GAO said, yeah, go ahead.
Were there any radioactive releases from that?
No. There was, you know, and if there was, it was quite insignificant. And they were lucky because the partial collapse was a hole that left a small hole, but a lot of dirt fell on top of and kind of suppressed any escape from the tunnel. There was radiation coming out of the tunnel in such quantities that it was basically a no-fly zone above, you know, this hole. But they kind of quickly got that taken care of. And so there was not a substantial release of radioactivity. And that was, you know, what we call a wake-up call, because it could have been much worse or kept going, and there probably would have been a release in other circumstances, especially if it was really windy.
Now, was there high-level waste stored there?
No. It was residual contamination on cars, and train cars were in there, and there was certainly plutonium down there. So there was a lot of contamination, but that was not considered high-level waste. You know, we're looking at the scenarios where a tank or more than one tank could collapse. These are really old tanks. They're made of concrete and steel, but they're all degraded. So even a small earthquake could probably, you know, cause a collapse. And I don't know what they do about that other than run. If that started to happen out there, and it would be the end of the cleanup. But they've got other facilities that now that the GAO has pointed it out, the Department of Energy is trying to hurry up and get on top of some of the worst ones. One is a trench called the Z Trench that has so much plutonium in it that they've been worried about criticality happening in these trenches. That's so much plutonium that it could actually go critical and release neutron, and that would be a very bad day.
Be an explosion, basically, right? A nuclear explosion.
Yeah, it just would be terrible. So now they are. So this one Z trench has about 100 pounds of plutonium in it. That's a lot, and it needs to be removed. And now they're putting out that, you know, this thing is in danger of collapse. If even, you know, if a very small amount of this stuff were to escape into the air and blow around, you know, you'd be looking at a significant event. It'd be hard to clean that up. Obviously, if you distributed 100 pounds of plutonium into the air, that would just be enough to kill everyone on the planet, basically. I mean, it's just so much. You know, we measure fatal doses of plutonium in the millionths of a gram. So it's there's just a lot of, you know, potential health effect from a release of that magnitude happening from something like this. So now the Department of Energy is going to be putting out a public comment period where they're proposing to once again use concrete to stabilize the tunnel and two other facilities. So there are three facilities like this that are in danger of collapse, and concrete seems to be their go-to answer for everything these days, as opposed to, you know, biting the bullet and going out and actually cleaning it up. There's old facilities out there. There's a building called Redox It was an old reprocessing facility. They just shut it down and kind of walked away from it, leaving a very large inventory of radioactive material inside, with chemicals as well. You know, they had a comment period about 2 years ago saying, well, should we go ahead and tear this down now or wait and maybe fix the roof or something? And we weighed in, and I know the Oregon weighed in saying, no, don't kick this can down the road, take care of it. But they decided just to wait. So now that's, you know, the fix to that is 10 years away. And, you know, we don't think they should wait. We think that if there were a collapse of that building, there would be a significant release potentially of radioactive and chemical materials and putting the Northwest at risk.
Well, you're listening to Lucas.
They don't want to spend the money.
Well, you're listening to Lucas Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Tom Carpenter, Executive Director of Hanford Challenge in Seattle, about the increasing challenges of cleaning up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Getting back to the contractors and the revolving door, it reminded me of something in one of the articles that you sent about why there was no kind of post-mortem, whatever, on the collapse of the Purex Tunnel 3 years ago. So talk about why they didn't go in and really determine what had caused the failure.
Well, because the tail wags the dog out there. The contractors didn't want to do it. And so the Department of Energy said, oh, okay, you don't have to do it then. It's like, why not? I mean, this is required. This is a nuclear facility. You should understand in detail what went wrong, how it went wrong, what you can do in the future to stop it from happening again, et cetera. They just didn't do it. And the GAO and Senator Wyden was very hard on Hanford and said, you guys are not doing your jobs and you're not protecting the public. They use pretty harsh language, and again, I think the Department of Energy is just captive to these contractors. There's so much money flowing. Hanford is getting $2.5 billion a year in cleanup money. That's a lot of dough for a little, you know, town in eastern Washington, and it speaks very loudly. So, if your job is as a regulator out there overseeing what these contractors do, your counterpart is making 4 to 5 times more than you are. And, you know, it's just human nature to say, well, gosh, I'm qualified to do that job. I could do a better job even, and to want to move over to the sunny side of the street, right, where the money is flowing. So we're kind of underpaying the federal officials. There's not enough of them. There's not enough regulation. And there's just a systemic problem with, I mean, there's nobody out there regulating health and safety except the Department of Energy itself. Just for instance, there's no OSHA inspectors. There's no, you know, Washington inspectors that go out there to assure that workers are being protected. That's left up to the Department of Energy to make that one of the things that they're supposed to do. And guess what happens? People who work out there get sick at a higher rate, get cancer at a higher rate. And, you can look at the compensation numbers for these workers, because there's now a compensation law in effect. And we're spending a lot on people, on treatments for people who are getting sick out there, simply because they worked at the Hanford site. The record keeping is poor, et cetera, et cetera. So it is just a systemic problem that Congress at some point is going to have to go in and fix. And one of the things that we and other organizations like Natural Resources Defense Council has been promoting is this idea that radioactive materials should be regulatable by the state of Washington, in particular, should have that power to assure that the mess at the Hanford site is actually going to get cleaned up and not abandoned by the federal government that's just simply tired of paying for the cleanup.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking that the Tri-Cities area, Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco, have been so dependent on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, basically for their livelihood since World War II, that they were first very resistant to having Hanford shut down the plutonium processing. And then when the first time I was out there in the early 80s, they were really working hard to make Hanford the national permanent waste repository for all the nuclear waste in the United States, which was a very bad idea, and it finally got shot down. But it seems like now the cleanup of Hanford is like the perpetual gig for the Tri-Cities area. And it's not, and even though it was supposed to be cleaned up 9 years ago, my understanding, I mean, back when I was there in the 80s, it was supposed to be done by 1999. So it seems like, how do you counter the mentality of the Tri-Cities area where they just want to be able to get this federal money forever, I suppose, to clean up Hanford forever?
You know, I think that you have to do the cleanup correctly, thoroughly, and in a manner that involves all of the stakeholders in the Pacific Northwest. You need to involve the tribes more in the decision-making, the environmental groups and citizens groups that oversee the Hanford site, the communities out there that live out there, the unions, et cetera. Everyone should have a say-so on how this site gets cleaned up, what it looks like after that cleanup is over. So we call that, what is the end state? And, you know, the tribes have a vision of Hanford cleanup of its restore it to the state in which you found it. In other words, dispose of all the radioactive materials out there and all the contamination out there. There's no scenario on the books where that would happen. So it would cost a lot of money and a lot of time to do that. But I appreciate their vision on that. And we at least have to remove the worst of those radionuclides, the ones that last millions of years. And it sounds like hyperbole, right? It's like millions of years. What's he talking about? Iodine-129 has a half-life of 15 million years, and it takes 10 half-lives for it to be considered gone. So it's 150 million years. That's how long this problem is going to last out there, and they're doing planning for 1,000-year cleanups right there in their documents. And that's as far as they look. And it's like, well, that doesn't do it, right? It's this is a dynamic area riddled with earthquake faults, volcanoes, glacial melt floods over time. If you take the really long view, Hanford's going to look very different in 10,000 years or even 5,000 years than it looks now. Heck, we don't know what it's going to look like in 100 years with global climate change. So this is not a place for shallow land burial of some of the most dangerous radionuclides on the planet. And yet, that is what's being contemplated here.
Well, there seems like there's a big problem in our culture with understanding time, especially long spans of time. And I guess one of the problems I was told actually by a couple engineers at Hanford a number of years ago, the biggest problem at Hanford is it was thought in terms of 4 and 8 year electoral cycles, and that everything, as soon as there was a new president elected in office, then it all went back to zero again. And so I wonder how we reconcile that. I mean, I have this funny response. I posted on Facebook the notice of this show, and I made a comment about how, you know, the coronavirus will come and go, and Hanford's contamination will still be with us for many millions of years. And somebody responded, oh, no, the Hanford is not a problem. The coronavirus is going to be with us forever. And I was thinking, this is, I don't know if he was joking or what, but it seemed like this is really a disconnect. I mean, to be able to equate something that is as temporal as viruses that come and go with this problem that I think people can't really begin to grasp. And I think when we think about all the environmental issues we're fighting right now in the Northwest, whether it's frack gas or whether it's issues with logging and species and extinction and stuff like that, it comes down to me that the longest-term problem we have is Hanford. And I wonder, how do we get people to understand what it means to have contaminants that are so dangerous that they will that they can kill for millions of years, way beyond a time that we can even imagine?
Yeah, we're not built that way, are we? You know, especially when you can't smell, you know, the danger. We're used to, like, opening a can of food, and it's like, oh, there's green stuff in here. It doesn't smell good. And so you know not to eat it. It's yucky, and it'll make you sick if you do. We learn which, plants are dangerous and inedible or poisonous. And so we know not to, you know, pick and eat certain mushrooms or plants. Radioactivity does not announce itself. You have to have a special instrument and maybe training, maybe a laboratory to tell what's in that substance that you're encountering, whether it's food or whether it's a dust particle that's floating in the air. And we're well into the nuclear age, so we have experienced already above-ground nuclear explosions, many hundreds of them, that have lifted a bunch of radioactivity into the air in the jet stream. We've had a couple of, you know, really bad accidents, Chernobyl in Ukraine and Fukushima in Japan, that released god-awful amounts of radioactivity into the air or into the ocean. And that's still, both those accidents are still happening. Chernobyl is still not cleaned up. It's far from cleaned up. It probably will never be cleaned up. It's simply under this big sarcophagus, right, this concrete thing, but the molten fuel is still down there. It still threatens the groundwater. It still threatens to, you know, catch on fire or something like that. Fukushima is three reactors that melted down. They're not quite sure where where the reactors are or how long it will take. I read recently that they're estimating that it'll be 2046 before they get that accident cleaned up. But in the meantime, you know, the very large areas of contamination have been, you know, rendered hundreds of square miles uninhabitable, both in Japan and in Russia, even though they're, you know, because of the accidents, both at Chernobyl and in Fukushima. And then there's other accidents that people don't really know that much about, in Mayak in Russia, you know, where there were explosions of underground nuclear waste tanks. There were fires, there were tornadoes that hit dried up lake beds that were highly contaminated, and just, you know, you can go to Siberia now and drive through an area where it says, you know, keep your windows closed, do not stop for any reason, don't get out of your car, because of the contamination is so vast. This is from an accident that happened in 1957. So there's, you know, it's going to be a long, long time before it's safe to use that area for any reason. And, of course, we use, you know, signs to warn people. You know, civilization were to break down and people forget that there's contamination in this area, the signs fall away or get vandalized or gone. People say, wow, here's an old abandoned village. I guess I'll live there, not knowing that it's radioactive and bad for your health. And so it's not something we should toy with. We are an advanced industrialized nation. We have lots of money. We have lots of technical know-how. And we have a duty to each other and to our future to make sure that we do the best possible job that we possibly can in removing these long-lived and highly radioactive materials, disposing of them properly at whatever the cost, to assure that these materials don't get out into the river systems or into the food supply and start blowing around, because once that happens, it's over. You're not going to ever recover that system again, just like we saw in Japan and in Russia. There's no going back. And Hanford may have, you know, areas that you'll never enter again for as long as we have memory and institutional processes, But we can take care of some of the worst of that. And we're not on track to do that. And that's what is worrisome to us right now.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Tom Carpenter, Executive Director of Hanford Challenge in Seattle, about the increasing challenges of cleaning up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. A number of years ago, I interviewed an author of a book called About a Mountain, which was about the plans to make Yucca Mountain in Nevada the national nuclear waste repository. And there were a lot of concerns. I mean, and Harry Reid, among other people, really didn't want it to happen there. It still hasn't happened. But one of the interesting things in this book was he spent a lot of time talking about what kind of signage you would need. And I guess they were having meetings in Nevada back then to figure out, well, how can we communicate with civilizations 50,000, 100,000 years in the future? I'm not sure what they came up with. Is that part of the conversation around Hanford?
It was for a while. And some of us jokingly said, well, you should just have a sign with a guy in a business suit, you know, and a tie, saying, it's perfectly safe, come on in. And people would know to stay away. But we really haven't talked about that for a while. There's no institutional control like signs or fences that are going to last even a fraction of the amount of time that the danger is going to be present. Which is why, again, you go back to what science has said since the 1950s, when they recognized that high-level waste, which is very long-lived and very radioactive, needs to be dispositioned, you know, in an engineered control way, and that was to put it deep underground. And yes, Yucca Mountain has been, you know, canceled. It probably won't come back. It turned out to be a flawed repository with lots of issues, and politically it was unacceptable. It was kind of jammed down Nevada's throat. They went ahead and built it without qualifying the mountain. I think they probably would never have chosen it if they had done that. They found, you know, hot water circulating through inside that mountain in the last 3,000 years from thermal activity and volcanic activity. That's bad, right? It's supposed to be dry for a million years. So there's much better places than Yucca Mountain, and eventually, if you did put nuclear waste there, you would be contaminating local water supplies. They've got very few aquifers out there, so this doesn't qualify.
What are the possible places? I mean, I haven't heard any place being suggested since Yucca Mountain.
Well, actually, there is a new technique out there, which is being looked at, called deep isolation. And these are boreholes that go down a mile or more. And they're not very big. They're maybe 2 feet. And, you know, they've got this horizontal drilling technique now that the oil companies invented to be able to, you know, steal oil from your neighbor's land. And
or fracking. They use it a lot for fracking now, too.
Oh, is that right?
Well, yeah, and that's the way they're going to drill under the Klamath River and the Rogue River and the other rivers in southern Oregon to put the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline. They're going to use horizontal drilling to go under the rivers. So, yeah, it's spreading its use.
So there's technology that's been developed, and it's being looked at for possible nuclear waste disposal. And I know that, you know, some of the scientists that we like and respect are looking at this with interest. You know, the idea is that you would, you know, put the high-level waste or nuclear fuels in canisters and put it down these boreholes and stuff them into there, then backfill. It's way below the water table. And if the backfill is, you know, sufficient and it's far enough down, et cetera, then there's little risk of it coming back up, or of contaminating the groundwater or doing any harm into the future. Even an earthquake theoretically wouldn't affect it. So that is one technique that's being looked at that has some possibilities. But it's going to take something like that. And by the way, the law requires that any such repository that is built needs to be, the waste needs to be retrievable for at least 50 years. And they put that proviso in there in case, A, they find out that it's not as good as they thought it was going to be, or B, there is some other solution for neutralizing nuclear waste that's invented, that's better than just leaving it there. So that's, you know, right now there is no real good solution for neutralizing nuclear waste. It's got to decay away at its own rate of speed. But it's possible that, you know, as science understands, you know, the mechanics behind nuclear waste and nuclear materials, that, you know, there is a possibility of dealing with it down the road. Right now we don't have that, and but shallow land burial is the least desirable of all the solutions, but that is the direction that Hanford is headed.
So in the last couple minutes that we have, what can listeners do to make sure that the Trump administration doesn't go ahead and relabel high-level waste, low-level waste, and stop funding this necessary cleanup of Hanford?
Well, this is the most urgent issue at Hanford that I've ever seen. And I've worked on the Hanford site since the mid-1980s. I've represented dozens of whistleblowers out there. A lot of issues have come and gone. This one is the scariest. And I think, you know, the state and other groups see this the same way. Because if the government gets away with this, it would mean abandoning the great majority of Hanford's nuclear waste on site in shallow land burial. Maybe not even removing the waste from the tanks and just leaving that waste there and pumping concrete into the tanks. And they are primed to do that. We've heard that there are three tanks that they think contain high-level waste and the rest that they can just pump concrete into and walk away from, and that's insane. So it's people need to communicate with their members of Congress. You guys in Oregon are very lucky to have Senator Wyden, who pays very close attention to what's happening at Hanford, is one of the experts in Congress on Hanford, has done numerous, multiple hearings, is very, very engaged, meets with us quite often, meets with whistleblowers, really takes time out of his schedule to focus on this. And he's got quite a bit of power. He's been in Congress and in the Senate for a long time, and, you know, hopefully we'll have a blue Senate this time next year, right? And, you know, it is someone like that can help us swing over to giving the state more power to regulate these radionuclides.
How about your Washington senators?
Well, you know, Patty Murray is very interested in health and safety, much less interested in whistleblowers and some of the underlying problems there. Senator Cantwell has been, you know, very good on nuclear waste issues. We have Adam Smith, who is the chair of House Armed Services Committee. You know, he is very attentive to Hanford, even though Hanford's not in his district. He's here in Seattle. You know, he's called a congressman from Boeing, but, you know, he's really more attuned to the Boeing workers and the unions there. I like Adam quite a bit. He's, you know, he gives me meetings every time I ask. He does work with us, sends letters, you know, all that stuff. So he's a pretty powerful member of Congress. And that's the key, is they need to hear from us. Our governors need to hear from us that we won't take shortcuts as a solution to the Hanford cleanup. It can't be. And right now, the Trump administration is planning to cut $750 million off the Hanford cleanup budget at a time when the GAO has said you're not taking care of your environmental threats and your catastrophic failures that could happen, that could result in a Chernobyl or a Fukushima here in the Northwest. And we've got the inventories of radionuclides in very dangerous amounts where that could happen. And there's not time for me to describe them all because there's so many of them. You know, we asked what a DOE manager, would you list, you know, a few of your you know, what keeps you up at night problems as he was going out the door. And he did, and it was 50 issues, and some of them we didn't know that much about, and it was hair-raising about, you know, what needs to be taken care of out there, and there's not enough money to do it. And now there's even less if Trump gets his way. But, you know, we suspect that our members of Congress will fight hard to restore that budget. But here's the issue. We need more than the $2.5 billion to accomplish the cleanup in the next 10 years. We need to have increasing budgets to pay for everything that needs to happen out there quickly as the site degrades, as these buildings fall apart. We've been kicking the can down the road too much, and now it's starting to catch up, you know, and so we've got a big issue in front of us.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and maybe you can come back again soon and tell us what those 50 things are that keep that guy up at night.
All right.
We don't have time for today. Thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Okay, well, thanks. And if people want to hear more, then they can check our website, HanfordChallenge.org.
And I'll have a link to that on our website as well.
Okay. Thanks so much for having
me
on.
Thank you. We've been talking with Tom Carpenter, Executive Director of Hanford Challenge, based in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFGLPFM and KODXLPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends and family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next, we will talk with Craig Jasmer about Crystal Geyser's plans to build a bottled water plant in Randall, Washington. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Charles Mingus. Thanks for listening.
Like to play a peace title. Oh, Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me.